thank you for joining us on Renovation Podcast. Another day to come together. I'm John Oglesby. I'm here with Dr. Christopher Cohn, and we are going to continue our conversation on predestination. And I know we talked last time on specifically a lot of things, but one of the major things we talked about was the idea when we were in Ephesians 2, 5, 8, and 9, and we had talked about kind of the order of salvation. Does regeneration happen, and then that causes faith? Does faith, is that the cause of the effect of regeneration, or do they happen at the same time? Is it this idea that you know, God is out of time and we are in time, and there's this maybe a third door, right? Again, our second option for the name of this podcast was Third Door Podcast, right?
Right.
But is there a third door? And so we want to kind of continue on that line of thinking. And it's important to keep that in mind, because again, that's the kind of the root of the conversation here. We're trying to get to, eventually, we will get to the answer, the question of, did God show grace on a select few and then pass over the rest of humanity in their salvation? So this idea of limited atonement, is it biblical, is it not biblical? What are our grounds to stand on? And I think last time we spoke, there was a really good, you laid a really good foundation for us to kind of build off of. At least it was one of the key components to really come into a biblical answer on this idea of limited atonement. So we can continue that conversation. I wanted to kind of, I guess, pick up where we left off a little bit. We had talked about there at the end where, you know, we're in the kind of the natural law that we're in today is this idea of cause and effect, right? So, and I had talked about there's just a tension in this idea that they happen concurrently, that regeneration and faith, it seems in Ephesians 2, that it is, as we exegeted the passage, that these two happen at the same time, and that one does not cause the other. It's more grace causes salvation, and faith is that vehicle that happens, the vehicle for that. And so I want to kind of point to this idea or the doctrine of grace. If grace causes salvation, right, which we saw in Ephesians 2, how does that differ from the idea that regeneration causes faith? And you know, so that whole debate, how do we look at the doctrine of faith? Of grace.
Well, I love how you framed it, that grace is the cause of salvation and faith is the vehicle. I think that is a biblically correct way to approach it and a theologically accurate way, and it's pretty simple, right?
Which was stolen directly from you, by the way.
Oh, I don't think you're quoting me exactly. I won't take credit for that. All complaints sent to John Oglesby. Yeah. Just kidding. I think the difference between the two scenarios, so again, door number one, door number two in this context.
Right. Uh-huh.
Door number one here is regeneration. Door number two is grace. And the question is, door number one, is regeneration causing the faith? Door number two, is grace causing the faith? And what's the difference between these two doors? Maybe it's confusing that I'm talking about doors, but...
no, it helps. There's two options.
Yeah, we're right. Mixing metaphors. But
right.
I think the distinction is simply this. Regeneration is a very particular part of grace.
Right.
Where mm-hmm. grace is a general kindness of God bestowed upon those who don't deserve it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So... if I'm saying that grace is the cause, if I must have cause and effect, which I'm okay with to a degree, if I must have cause and effect, then I'm comfortable saying that grace is the cause. God's grace is the cause of salvation. But even in that setting, there's not necessarily a time element involved. Whereas for us, cause and effect means something happens and then there's a there's an action and then an equal and opposite reaction, right?
Right, right.
God isn't bound by the natural law that he created. And that's just such an overarching principle that we have to understand. God isn't bound by that. Mm-hmm. He's not bound by the morality that he places us under. Here's right. here's an example that I will often use. You know, I remember we had a sofa in our living room, and it was a brown sofa, and it would show anything. I mean, if you got anything on this sofa, it would just show, and it was kind of frustrating. You know, you go to a store and you see this fantastic looking sofa, and then you order it, and you actually get it, and it's a little different. It's not the same quality.
Right.
And that's kind of what it was. Anyway, so at the time, our daughters were really young, and Kathy and I we'd eat on the sofa, right? Wait a minute, you're talking about doors and sofas? What's going on? Just follow me here, right? So Kathy and I would eat on the sofa. It's our sofa, right? But we wouldn't let our daughters eat on the sofa. And imagine the hypocrisy, the utter hypocrisy.
I was about to say, you cruel person.
Okay. So I've gotten you to fall into the moral dilemma.
Right, yeah.
Okay? Uh-huh. Whose sofa is it? Well, it's my sofa. I paid for it. I bought it. It is my sofa. Therefore, who determines the rules of how that sofa will be used?
I do.
Because I own it, right?
Right.
So if I'm going to restrict my daughters, because at the time, you know, they're in 3 and 4 and 6, whatever, you know, in that general range-ish, and they eat a bowl of cereal, inevitably there's going to be a spill, right?
Right.
Whereas Kathy and I are maybe a little bit more adept at not spilling our cereal on the sofa. So it's within our prerogative to set a rule for our kids having to do with our sofa. And it's not hypocritical because it's our sofa.
Right.
Right? So there's no hypocrisy there. I own the sofa. Number one, I'm trying to teach my kids how to manage and be responsible, so that I'm trying to benefit them. Two, I'm trying to protect the sofa. That's not a bad thing, right?
Right.
And if there was an accident, fine, you know, life happens, it's okay. So it's not valuing property over people. But that's an example of how ownership means sovereignty,
right.
True ownership, okay? So now we fast forward a little bit, or rewind maybe, and we think about God. God is sovereign for a number of reasons. I mean, he just is. But he is worthy of that. One reason for that worthiness is he created. It's all his. He has ownership, right? So if he wants to say, including in his Mosaic covenant, a commandment that is, thou shalt not murder, he can do that.
Right.
But guess what he does every day?
Yeah.
Ever think about that?
I was about to say, I'm scared to give the answer I think you're looking for.
Send all complaints to John Ogilvie. Yeah, I'm kidding. God commits murder every day.
Yeah.
I'll say it for
yeah.
you, okay? And you can hear the gasps coming through.
I know.
What I mean is this. We would define murder. In fact, I'm going to, just to make sure I'm being even-handed about this, I am going to a popular web browser here, and I'm going to schmoogle the word murder. Let's get a definition. Okay. So here is, the noun is the unlawful, premeditated killing of one human being by another. Okay, now that's a very particular definition. So by that definition, with that noun, God couldn't do that because, first of all, it's unlawful and he's not under a law. So by this definition, you could mm-hmm. not say that God is murdering anybody.
Yeah.
And that's kind of my point. The definition works in favor of the argument that you and I are not permitted to kill one another, right? There's law. Well, where does that law come from? Well, it's in Genesis, right? Genesis 9. Because of the image of God in humanity, that's why murder is wrong. Okay, so I can't murder you, and you can't kill me because it would be unlawful, because God said you can't do it because my image is in humanity. Now, every day, all over the world, there are natural things that happen, earthquakes, tragedies. Things that God has the power to stop, and he doesn't stop them in many instances. And so he is actively involved in his creation, and people are dying. Now, how is that not murder? By this definition, first of all, is it unlawful? Well, he is the sovereign who determines law.
Right.
If we say he's under law, then wouldn't that make law God instead of God? God wouldn't be the highest authority, right?
Right, right.
So the challenge is understanding that God is above his creation, and he's not bound to the rules that he places us under. In other words, he's got a sofa, and we're not allowed to eat on the sofa, and that doesn't make him a hypocrite.
Right.
Okay? It doesn't make him immoral.
Yeah, so... just this might be a little bit of a rabbit trail, but we're talking about the law and
we're
God
way
and
down
the law.
Rabbit.
Yeah, so but I've heard it many times where, and this is my understanding, is that the law is a I want to say byproduct, but kind of a byproduct of God's character. So like holiness is coming from God. So like the law would be based on God's holiness and his character and things like that. So how does that, is that unbiblical, first of all? And then if it's not, how does that kind of work with what you're saying?
So let me give you a sarcastic answer.
Oh, no.
So is it against God's character to eat shrimp? Is there something in God's character that eating shrimp is somehow sinful? But then, oh, by the way, now that we're not under the law, that it's okay for Jewish people to eat shrimp now. My point is, that is a really significant piece of Reformed theology.
Okay.
Okay? The idea that the law is what it is because it's reflective of God's character, to the extent that... well, realize the implication. If the law comes out of God's character, does God's character ever change? No.
No. Right.
Therefore, in Reformed and Covenant theology, we are still under the law today. Not the ceremonial law, which these divisions are artificial, but they would say
man-made. Right.
Not the ceremonial law. And not the civil law, but the moral law. And some would say the civil law. Some postmillennialists, they would be called theonomists.
Right.
They would say we're under the whole thing. But the typical Reformed Covenant thinker is acknowledging we are under the law for our sanctification because the law comes from the character of God. And I'm giving one example with my snide shrimp comment that, in fact, the law is not coming out of his character. It is a set of mandates that he put on these people for a very specific purpose. And he tells us what that purpose is. And it doesn't, it's not so bound up in his character that he can't change the law.
Right.
Which he has.
Right.
So this is a really good example. Of trying to understand the role of law and God's responsibility in it. Because if he's under law, then law is above him.
Right.
If he's bound to law for any reason, then that law is over him. And if that's the case, then he is hypocritical and he is immoral and all these things. If he is bound by these things, then he cannot... do some of the things that it seems the scripture has him doing in a literal grammatical historical interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the reasons that some will get away from the literal grammatical historical interpretation so that they can redeem God from some of these actions so that he won't violate this structure of law comes from his character.
And I think that, you know, this is, again, a little bit of a rabbit trail, but this is the this is an important aspect of answering questions such as we see, you know, throughout the historical books of the Bible and Kings and things like that, where they're driving out people. How could that happen? Isn't that totally against what God's about? Well, is it?
You know? It's a great question. First of all, in those settings, you know, God is sometimes accused of genocide, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
In those settings, first of all, we see that God told the Israelites to drive them out, not to kill them, mm-hmm. but to remove them. And that in itself sounds really mean, but here's just an interesting little bit where we see God's sovereignty and his grace and mercy coming into play. Let's just look at Genesis 15 for a second. And as Abraham is having this conversation with God, God makes a mm-hmm. covenant with him, and he puts Abraham to sleep, essentially. And he says in verse 13, God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, for there they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. Okay, that's a long time. And you look at that and you're thinking, man, that's mean, God. Why would you allow Abram's descendants, you're promising them blessing, why would you allow them to be, you know, strangers and enslaved and oppressed in a land for 400 years? Well, verse 14, "But I will also judge the nation whom they serve, and afterward they'll come out with many possessions." So he'll resolve that well, but notice verse 16. "Then in the fourth generation they'll return here." And what's that next phrase? "For the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete."
Yeah.
So God is going to allow the descendants of Abraham to be enslaved in a land for 400 years because the land that God is promising them belongs to someone else. And he is going to allow them 400 years of grace, 400 years of holding off the judgment. That's incredible grace. But yet he's also sovereign in recognizing and stating this is what's going to happen. This is how I'm going to do it.
Right. I think too that, I mean, just another example is even, you know, he says you're going to be your people will be enslaved for 400 years. And even the deliverance from that slavery, which we can see later on is in Egypt, even the purpose in that judgment on Egypt, we see if you, it's in Exodus, but I could quickly get to Romans 9, verse 17. It says, "For Scripture says to Pharaoh, 'For this very purpose I raised you up, to demonstrate my power in you, and that my name might be proclaimed throughout the whole earth.'" The grace of God showing himself to the whole world was done through a judgment on a nation.
Right.
And it's like that. How could God destroy like that? But then look at the grace that's shown in that as well, delivering his people. He fulfills his promise that he gave to Abraham in Genesis 15. And then we see the grace is shown in that judgment through essentially himself proclaiming himself to all the world and that he might be known by the world. And that grace is seen even in that judgment as well.
And it comes down to a matter of trust. Here's this great sovereign creator God who demonstrates control, mm-hmm. and he demonstrates incredible grace and kindness also. So in those areas where we can't see, right, we can't understand, there's gaps that he doesn't fill in. The question is, are we going to condemn him, applying our own moral standards to him, placing him under those mm-hmm. moral standards? Or are we going to trust him that, you know what, he's the creator, he's sovereign, perhaps he knows what he's doing? One of those approaches is arrogant and the other isn't, right? Yeah. In this case, I'm going to go through door number two.
Yeah.
In this case. So the punchline here, and we've got a whole lot to explore, and there's a bunch of rabbit trails and things we could talk about here. The punchline is that God is completely in control and he exercises mercy and grace. And that is an underlying premise of any discussion of predestination or how he's working with nations and peoples. Now, one little quick implication. We talked about the viewpoint that the law comes out of his character.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, think about this. The law, the Mosaic law, prohibited intermarriage, racial intermarriage.
Right.
Okay. And some have taken that, you know, in the past 100 years, have taken that as a continuation, and kind of maintained a kind of racism,
mm-hmm.
because of the law. Now, it's not because of the law, because the law itself is trying to keep Israel separate from the nations. And he says, if you marry within these nations, they will lead you astray and you'll worship other gods. It has nothing to do with race or ethnicity. It has to do with who Israel was and the nations around them. So as we fast forward to our time, some who have a flawed view of the law and of God's character can actually justify racism.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to be really careful. If we misunderstand God's character and his rights as the creator, we can end up in some pretty dark places.